Well, beloved, this is the last Sunday of December and our last Sunday for 2021. The next time we meet on a Sunday, we'll be looking at a new month and a new year. This particular month, I have brought forth a series about the great red dragon of Revelation 12. And as I mentioned in the past, during our Nativity series, which we do in December, I, over the past 14, 15 years, have tried to bring a message dealing on either the characters or the theology. We even considered the hymns that we sing a few years back on the theology that can be found in the Christmas carols that we sing. I believe a lot of people sing those Christmas carols, whether they're a Hollywood actor putting on a story about Christmas, it may be a romantic movie, or it may be a very serious movie, and in that movie you have these Hollywood actors. We don't know whether they're saved or not, most of them are not, but they make good money acting and being an actress. They'll sing these Christmas carols as part of the movie, maybe in a church setting or in a family setting. I kind of wonder if these people ever think what they're singing while they get their big paychecks. Well, beloved, there's even theology can be found, rich theology in many of the old ancient Christmas hymns and carols that we sing. And we brought that forth. And we brought forth lessons on the shepherds about King Herod, even the wise men. We looked at Mary and Joseph. We looked at John the Baptist, his parents respectively, and Jesus respectively and such. Well, there's another character that most people don't even consider. And I mentioned this last Sunday, so I know that I'm repeating myself. And that's the great red dragon in Revelation 12. Is he not presented with his gaping mouth open, waiting and ready to swallow and to destroy the man-child that is being born in that imagery? Yeah. So the devil apparently is a key figure in the Christmas story, if you will. He was there. And his designs and his devices has always been to lie, cheat, steal, and murder. And so today I'd like to conclude with two more installments to that series. We're going to consider a Pharaoh, and we're going to consider Haman the Agagite. Or, in some manuscripts, Haman the Gogite. The Gogite. Gog and Magog of Ezekiel 37, 38, 39. Well, let's turn to Exodus chapter 1 this morning for our text. Exodus chapter 1. So yes, we are finally moving out of the book of Genesis. If you notice, a lot of the stories showing Satan's design and his devices to somehow derail the coming of the Messiah, to derail the Son of God, the Savior of the world, you find a whole lot of these incidences, if you will, in the book of Genesis. At the very beginning, if you will. Is not Genesis called the book of beginnings? So in the very beginnings of the drama of redemption, okay, that God put in place before the world began, the devil was front and center in trying to overturn or to derail or to hinder or to stop or to prevent the seed of the woman coming and becoming our Savior, our Lord, our King, and our Master. Verse 8. Well, let's go back to verse 7. And the children of Israel were fruitful, and increased abundantly, and multiplied, and waxed exceedingly mighty, and the land was filled with them. Now, we're talking about Moses has not yet arrived on the scene. They've been in Egypt land ever since Joseph, way back in the closing chapters of the book of Genesis. And God had given to Abraham a prophecy that's some four centuries, at least 400 years plus. His descendants would be in a land called Egypt, and that eventually the Egyptians were going to oppress his descendants. And here we're being told that despite the oppression, the Israelites were growing in leaps and bounds with children. Verse 8, now there arose up a new king over Egypt, which knew not Joseph. So between verse 7 and 8, that 400-year period of time has now been ticking away. And now in history, in Egyptian history, the pharaohs in the time of Joseph were known as the Hyksos, and they were more related to Abraham's descendants because they were Shemites. Now, the Hyksos, which I believe from my history, they kind of ruled the roost for a couple of centuries. And at that time, Egypt, the Egyptians themselves, were very weak. This was one of those low points in Egyptian history. Well, as those 400 years are now ticking away, eventually down in the south, okay, a new Egyptian king, a real Egyptian king, comes to power. And he amasses his forces to such a degree that he heads north and drives out the Hyksos, who will then return back into Canaan and all the way up into modern-day Turkey. They flee back into the land of what we know to be as Canaan. And the second peak of Egyptian history now begins. So when it says this pharaoh who knew not Joseph, yeah, this is an Egyptian pharaoh. The pharaoh at the very beginning was a Hyksos. He was an outsider, but because of conquest, they were running Egypt, and the Hyksos kings were the pharaohs at that time. That's your Egyptian history, free of charge. And he said unto his people in verse 9, behold, the people of the children of Israel are more and mightier than we. So this new Egyptian pharaoh sees he has a problem on his northern border. He has a large contingency of people who are not Egyptians, living in the best of the land, and bordering his northern boundary. And thus, they could easily become an ally of anyone in Canaan who would have any desire to head south and conquer Egypt. You have this mask of Israelite men who would become ideal warriors if they were allowed, ally themselves with another invader from the north or from the east. And Pharaoh here is looking at his numbers on his chessboard, and he sees a major problem on his northern border. Come now, let us deal wisely with them, lest they multiply. And it come to pass that when there falleth out any war, they join also unto our enemies and fight against us, and so get them up out of the land. Now look at verse 10. I'm not stretching it. Pharaoh was quite concerned on what was now gathering up on his northern border, in the best part there in the land of Goshen, which was rich farming land, okay? Growing crops, raising livestock, beautiful climate, lots of water to plant and to irrigate and to water livestock. It was abundantly, as opposed to way down south where you had just that ribbon of river, the Nile River, with the overflowing of its banks. There's only so many miles on either side of the Nile River where you can grow anything. And then it's almost a perfect line of demarcation where the greenery stops and the desert begins. But in the delta, it fans out. Okay? It fans out. But all these little river tributaries providing rich silt, lots of water to grow crops, to raise livestock, and to live abundantly. Verse 11, therefore, they did set over them taskmasters to afflict them with their burdens. And they built for Pharaoh treasure cities, Python and Ramesses. But the more they afflicted them, now notice, the more the Egyptians afflicted them, the more they multiplied and grew. And they were grieved because of the children of Israel. Now, verses 12 also has both a physical and a spiritual application in church history. What did Tertullian say in the 3rd century, in the 200s? The blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. The more you kill us, the more we come back, literally speaking. This is also something that you will find in church history. When the Roman Empire sporadically began to harass the church grew more. And in times of persecution, the church grows more. If you don't believe me, Think of the persecution that your Russian brothers and sisters were being put under during the Cold War. They're in China. There are a lot of Christians that are underground. Lots and lots of Christians. And they're under more oppression than what we are. You have a very strong Christian element even in North Korea, despite all the harassment, which is quite brutal. They still grow. And so it seems here, just like here, the more the Egyptians physically harassed the Jews and put them under the whip, the more they multiplied. Conversely, the more the children of God, i.e. the Church of Christ, us, the true Israel, when we're harassed, when we're persecuted, we grow more. Isn't it ironic that when the church married the state under Constantine, that's when the church became eventually apostate and transformed itself into the Roman Catholic cult that you see today? When the church and the state marry and jump in the same bed, you create a vicious, bloodthirsty monster. Just read church history, real church history. And the Egyptians made the children of Israel to serve with rigor. And they made their lives bitter with hard bondage in mortar and brick and all manner of service in the field. All their service wherein they made them serve was with rigor. And the king of Egypt spake to the Hebrew midwives. Now watch this. Watch the devil's plan, of which the name of the one was Sifra and the name of the other Puah. And he said, when ye do the office of a midwife to the Hebrew women, when your Hebrew women go into labor, and now they call for the midwife to come and bring that child into the world, and you see them upon the stools, if it be a son, then ye shall kill him. But if it be a daughter, then she shall live. Now notice, if you eventually kill off all the Jewish boys that are being born, but you spare the women or the little baby girls, you're going to kill any hopes of a Messiah born in Bethlehem stable, number one. Number two, because of that, you're going to make it kind of impossible for the Jewish race at this time to continue propagating if all you have is girls running around and no eligible men who are Israelites to marry them. Who would these Israelite girls be forced to marry? A non-Jew or a non-Israelite. And therefore, in the devil's thinking, in his design and his devices to torpedo the babe born in Bethlehem stable, and he failed on other accounts, as we've seen this month from story to story, he now comes up with this ingenious idea to commit infanticide, the killing of children. And isn't it amazing that we have modern-day pharaohs, like the Supreme Court, and local federal judges, and even ministers of the gospel, who advocate the killing of a child even today, either in the womb or just about to be born, and in some instances, allowing a child who has been fully developed in the womb, brought into this world by either natural birth or by a cesarean birth, survive being born, and then being put in a closet and left to die by order of a doctor, or maybe by the wishes of the mother who brought that child into the world. We have modern-day pharaohs today. And so since the devil was really behind all of this, you have to wonder who was behind those today in the Planned Parenthood organization. Who is really behind those who advocate the slaughtering of a child who's being developed in its mother's womb, or to even kill a child who has only his neck and its head in the birth canal, while the rest of the body hangs limp into this new world, and having a scissors put into the back of the neck cutting the brainstem, watching the baby shriek in pain, extend itself in jerks as it feels the pain of the scissors cutting its brainstem, and then inserting a tube into the brain of the child, sucking out the brain, and making it easy for the mother to pass the rest of her child, her dead child, into this new world. You ever wonder who's behind that? Oh yes, it's the Planned Parenthood organization, I know, and the doctors and the attendants in the abortion factories, I understand that, and the legislators who passed the laws protecting infanticide. But who's the real culprit behind all that? None other than the Red Dragon of Revelation 12. Was he not trying to kill? In that imagery that John gives us in Revelation 12, was he not dead set to destroy the child, the man-child who was about to be born, who was to be the king of all nations, right? So there's my proof. Now, how did these Hebrew women respond? But the midwives feared God. So now come the pro-lifers into the picture. And did not as the king of Egypt commanded them, but saved the man-child alive. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives. Now this king had the power to kill these women for their disobedience. Now you see the providential hand of God as he protects these women because of what they're doing. And the king of Egypt called for the midwives and said unto them, why have you done this thing and have saved the man children alive? He wants an explanation. Number one, why are you saving these children? Especially while these boys, baby boys. And secondly, why have you defied my edict? So what do we have here? We have a picture like today of the state asking us, the church, why we will not comply to the state mandates and the edicts that are not only unconstitutional, but above all, violate the scriptures. Because notice what the women say. And the midwives said unto Pharaoh, because we Hebrew women are not as the Egyptian women. Now what does that mean? Are we talking about the way they look, the mascara, the makeup, the fake eyebrows and eyelashes? What is being implied by that statement? We are not like your Egyptian women. It would seem to imply to this pastor that the Egyptian women didn't mind killing their children. What's the context here? We're not talking about the way the women dress. We're not talking about the makeup and no makeup. We're not talking about how they puff up their hair and how they go around with the latest fashions. What's the context? We're talking about infanticide, the killing of a child. These women tell Pharaoh, right to his kisser, we are not as the Egyptian women. For they are lively and are delivered ere the midwives come in unto them. Therefore God dealt well with the midwives. So God did something to prevent the Pharaoh, who, beloved, at this time in its historical context, saw himself as God on earth. Today, the government, if you haven't noticed, in this past year and maybe the past 2 years, has come out of its box and has acted as if they are the gods and we are the servants. Have you noticed that with all of the COVID hubbub, the fear, the intimidation, firing people for not getting a vaccination, mandating and forcing people to do things that they would not normally do? Isn't it amazing that 2 or 3 years ago, you had a boss and his subordinates getting along, hunky-dory. COVID now comes into the picture. And the monster in the White House, who thinks he's God, lets loose with these mandates. And a boss and his subordinates, who were getting along hunky-dory up until 2019, this boss all of a sudden turns 180 and looks at his subordinates and says, unless you get the vaccination, you can't have your job. And the handful that don't get their vaccination, he fires just before Christmas. Ever wonder what has happened in 2 years? When 3 years ago, the same people were getting along hunky-dory at the Christmas party or at the 4th of July company picnic? Or maybe this particular boss was passing out bonuses at the end of the year because of a job well done? Isn't it amazing how the state, acting in the place of God, can force people to turn on each other a complete 180? And it ought not to be a shock, because we saw the same thing being played out just 90 years ago in Germany, in Italy, and in Japan. How the government can come into your life and sever relationships, even within a family, over a mandate or a restriction that comes down from on high. You see the same thing being played out here. It's only several thousand years ago. I'm talking about right now. We'll read on. Verse 20 says, God dealt well with these midwives. And the people multiplied, waxed very mighty. And it came to pass, because the midwives feared God, that God made them houses. And Pharaoh charged all his people, saying, every son that is born ye shall cast into the river, and every daughter ye shall save alive. So notice that despite what the midwives were doing, notice the mandate in verse 22. The midwives were not cooperating, just like many Christians today are not or should not cooperate with any government order that violates conscience and the scriptures. And so what does the government do? Throws out this open mandate, like here. Pharaoh gives this decree, every son born ye shall cast into the river. Since the midwives won't kill them, I want you parents to kill them by throwing your sons into the river, the Nile. Beloved, do you see the striking parallel between Exodus 1 and what is going on currently in our government, in our culture, in this nation, and in our society? Our government is now acting in the place of God, and what is happening? Families are turning against each other. Bosses against the worker against the boss, the subjects against the government, and the government against its subjects. What is the devil's divine and devices? To rob, to cheat, to steal, and to kill, and to cause what? Division. Division. Well, so far this year's Nativity 2021 series, we have seen more than one attempt by the Red Dragon of Revelation 12 to derail the plan of redemption. A plan that was conceived within the very Godhead before the foundation of the world. Others have cited similar schemes of the devil to undermine the plan of redemption. Let me give you some other instances that are peppered in the Old Testament that I have not had a chance to address today, but I'm going to throw them on the table and have you think. What about Balak, king of Moab, hiring Balaam to curse Israel? This is found in Numbers 23. So here the devil finds himself a prophet for hire. And he finds King Balak, who sees this multitude traversing into his territory, and he wants to hire someone to literally damn this nation. I want them cursed. Well, stop and think. Would not a curse, if it really fell effectively on the Israelites, would that not have had a negative impact on the babe born in Bethlehem making his arrival? You're going to have a Messiah come from a nation who's been damned or cursed? See, we think awfully shallow about these stories. We say, well, that's a nice story there about this prophet for hire. We read our Bibles, beloved, and we make no connection what came before and apparently what comes after. Stop and think. Stop and think if King Balak got his way. Stop and think if Balaam had the power to curse an entire nation and thus have a negative effect upon the coming of the Messiah. So what does God do? Here's my proof. Balak and Balaam go on top of a mountain overlooking this nation. They look like bees, they're like hornets, they're like locusts. Several million. And as soon as the prophet for hire is about to open his mouth, God grabs the vocal cords and pronounces a blessing. There's my proof. There's the proof. And when King Balak has a conniption fit and wants to throw more money into the prophet for hire, like most pastors today, they're just out to be hired, a hireling. They have real no concern for God's people because they spend more time correcting the Bible than simply preaching and teaching it. So when Balaam is about to prophesy again, when he's about to prophesy again, a blessing comes forth. A blessing comes forth. But that's not the end of the story. King Balak looks at Balaam and says, "You failed." But Balaam comes up with an ingenious plan. And that plan was, well, if I can't curse him, you might as well simply join them. And what was Balaam's strategy with King Balak? Is to take the women of King Balak's empire, his little kingdom, and have them fall in love with all the Israelite men. That's one way to pollute the genealogical line. You got to read your Bibles, beloved, with everything contextually that comes before and everything that comes after the story. Here's another one most people do not consider. What about King Saul, the first king of Israel, his stubborn appetite to kill young David? You find this in 2 Samuel. King Saul diverted so much time, energy, and wealth and resources in hunting and killing one man. What if King Saul succeeded in killing David? Stop and think. Was David not at the table one time when King Saul, in a fit of rage, took a javelin and threw it at David, and David was able to escape? It hit the wall, but David escaped. What if David was hit by that instrument of war? What if David died right then and there at Saul's dinner table? What would happen? The royal line would have been cut. Because you do have Adam to Noah, Noah to Shem, right? Shem, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Jacob down to Judah, Benjamin. Benjamin what? Obed, Jesse, David, Solomon. You killed David. That thin thread of red is gone. It becomes detached. And again, Christians read their Bibles with no contextualness on what comes before and what comes after. Here's another one that most people do not even consider. What about the Egyptian bondage that God prophesied to Abraham in Genesis 15? What if the toil and the oppression during the 400 years, when the new king comes on the scene, what if that king and his oppression and ruling over the Israelites with that rigor, what if in the course of the latter part of those 400 years, that royal line became extinguished because of death that came to that family line that was living in Egypt during those 400 years? You gotta stop and think. Now, as we return to our text here, it seems that Satan was using a pagan king who, in the Egyptian ideology and in their worldview, was God on earth. He sees himself as a god on earth, was now energized to commit a form of genocide quite similar to China's one-child policy. I'm going to read to you something on that here in a second. Something else that most Christians do not realize, that sacrificing children was practiced by quite a number of people in the ancient world, and even more so in the modern world. Let me give you a list of people. The Babylonians, the Canaanites, the Celts of England and Ireland, the Aztecs, the Toltecs, the Incas, the Amaleks, the Mesoamerican native population, the Mayans, Central South America, Europeans. When you read history of the Middle Ages, if you had a new king come on the throne, and the previous king had a bunch of sons, okay, who could have been the next king, and could have provided contention to his throne, he would have those kids wiped off the map, killed the whole family. The Orientals did the same thing, the Chinese and the Japanese. They would extinguish an entire family when a new leader would come on the throne. The easiest way to keep your opponents away from your throne is to genocide or to wipe them off the face of the globe. So there are many cultures that have come before us who have killed children. Some of the Canaanites practice a form of child sacrifice. And even the nation of Israel, both the 10 northern tribes and the 2 southern tribes, Judah and Benjamin, they fell prey to assimilating the sacrifices or the sacrificing of their own children. Let me read to you a little snippet. Infanticide or infant homicide is the intentional killing of infants or offspring. Infanticide was a widespread practice throughout human history that was mainly used to dispose of unwanted children. Now, what are we here today on this pro-death position? An unwanted child. Why bring a child into a family that is riddled with poverty? We don't want to burden this mother with another mouth to feed and another body to wash and clothe. We got to think about the mother's well-being, her psychological well-being. We can't afford to have this poor woman bring this child into the world and now to be burdened with so much anxiety and inward and outward stress and fear and the unknowing of the future. She doesn't want it. So we'll just simply kill it. Beloved, that term, an unwanted children, ought to make you cringe. Unwanted? Then why did you lay on your back and have sex outside of marriage? What, all the means of protection today? So you get yourself pregnant in an act of fornication or an act of adultery, and then you begin to realize, oops, I have a child inside of me? And the father of this girl or the boyfriend of this girl now applies the pressure. You don't want to be burdened with this child. You don't really want this, do you? We'll take you down to the abortion clinic, and for several hundred dollars, we'll just simply take it away. We'll remove the problem. Stop and think about those words. Stop and think about the mentality that is behind that. Stop and think of the spirit that is further behind that mentality. Its main purpose, the prevention of resources being spent on weak or disabled offspring. Unwanted infants were normally abandoned to die of exposure, but in some societies, they were deliberately killed. In ancient Rome, when a child was born, that baby, whether boy or girl, was laid at the father's feet. Strongly patriarchal culture. That recently born child wrapped in its blanket, laying at Papa's feet. If Daddy bent down and picked up the child, it was allowed to live. If the Papa simply walked away, the servants came, took that baby, went out there in the woods, and left it for the wolves to eat. Y'all Christian brothers and sisters of some 2,000 years ago would be in those woods. And your brothers and sisters would take those left babies, those abandoned babies, as their own kin, and would raise them and nurture them and teach them about the Christ who saves sinners. Did you know that? Most don't, because they don't read. Infanticide is now widely legal. Now it's legal to kill. But in some places, the practice is tolerated or the prohibition not strictly enforced. Infanticide is reportedly used by the state of North Korea as a punitive or a social control measure. It may be used to have been or may be used or have been used recently in other totalitarian states, also in some tribal societies. In some societies, if a child is born with physical deformities, it was not allowed to live. In their mind, in their worldview, the parents did something to offend some deity in the sky, and therefore that child was born with this infirmity, and therefore the child cannot be allowed to live. When I was in Korea the first time, 74 to 75, there was a gentleman that came to the Haven, the church there that was downtown. He had a fake arm, a fake right arm. It was made of plastic, and it had all the fine details of human flesh, fingernails, and all the little lines you see on real flesh. It had all of that. He was born with a deformity, and he was an outcast to his family. When we met him, we automatically extended our right hand to his fake hand to shake. He pulled that arm away, but we insisted on shaking the fake hand. It gave him a sense of worth. That's how some people think. Most Stone Age human societies routinely practice infanticide, and estimates of children killed by infanticide in the Mesolithic, Neolithic eras vary from 15 to 50%. You ever wonder how we even got around to being born ourselves? If our ancestors were killing between 15 and 50% of their children? Infanticide continued to be common in most societies after the historical era began, including Greece, Rome, Phoenicia, China, Japan, Aboriginal Australia, Native Americans, and Native Alaskans. So killing children, beloved, is part and parcel of the human race. Question, who or what was the spirit behind all of that? We see an example right here in the text. Pharaoh wanted all boy babies immediately killed by the midwives. How did they do it? Strangle? I don't know how they did it, but they did something. He wanted them to do something to prevent those little infant boys from becoming men and becoming potential enemies as soldiers to an invading army to his north. That was his motive. He was counting the numbers on his chessboard, and the numbers were not looking too good for Egypt. And something had to be done. So under the guise of protecting Egypt, he chooses to kill Hebrew children. Infanticide became forbidden in Europe and in the Near East during the first millennium. Christianity forbade infanticide from its earlier times, which led Constantine the Great and Valentinian the First to ban infanticide across the Roman Empire in the 4th century. Notice the impact that the church had on the state at this time. The practice of killing children comes to a complete end in the 4th century because of what? Light and salt. The practice ceased in Arabia in the 4th century after the founding of Islam, since the Quran prohibits infanticide. Infanticide of male babies had become uncommon in China by the Ming Dynasty, 1368 to 1644, whereas infanticide of female babies became more common during the one-child policy between 1979 and 2015, time period in which you walked this earth. In China, between 1979 and 2015, to curb the massive population explosion, if a Chinese family had a female baby, you could throw it in the Yellow River. Every Chinese daddy wanted a boy. Well, they came to realize by 2015, now you do the math, 1979 to 2015, do the math. They come to realize if you got rid of all these girls, who would the Chinese boys marry? Where would they go find a bride? See how stupid we are? See how stupid mankind can be? During the period of the Comply Rule in India and in the East Indian Company attempted to eliminate infanticide, but were only partially successful. Female infanticide in some parts of India still continues today. Infanticide is now very rare in industrial countries, but may persist elsewhere. Parental infanticide researchers have found that mothers are far more likely than fathers to be the perpetrator of the killing of a child. The very one who brought that child into the world, apparently, is the person with the greater purpose and desire to kill her own flesh and blood. Look at 2 Kings chapter 3. We are told not to be fooled and not to be ignorant of Satan's devices. And beloved, we see Pharaoh trying to use a device probably placed into his mind by that red dragon somehow to torpedo the drama of redemption. I'm laying on the table that Pharaoh was being used by the devil in an attempt to get rid of any hope of Christ being born in Bethlehem. He had failed in the book of Genesis, but now he thought he had an opportune time with a man who had the power and the resources to get it done. Look at verse 26. 2 Kings chapter 3. Verse 26. And when the king of Moab saw that the battle was too sore for him, so here's this battle during the time of Israel's kings and Judah's kings. Moab is at war, and the king of Moab sees that the battle's not going too well for him. He took with him 700 men that drew swords to break through even unto the king of Edom, but they could not. Then he took his eldest son that should have reigned in his stead and offered him for a burnt offering upon the wall. And there was great indignation against Israel, and they departed from him and returned to their own land. So in order for this king to placate the gods, this Moabite king, in order to win the battle against the Israelites, he offers in his mind the greatest of all gifts that he could give to his Moabite gods and goddesses. He burns his oldest son alive, who would have been the next king of Moab, if you read verse 27 carefully. Beloved, this was, we don't know how old the son was, but stop and think. Would you burn one of your own children to make God happy, that your God would move in a favorable disposition towards whatever you want, a good season for crops, a good healthy business for 2022? Would you literally take your child that you have brought into this world and burn him alive just to win a war? Here it is. Turn to chapter 16. Just giving you a few examples, beloved, that this is killing of children is no stranger. Verse 1. In the 17th year of Pekah, the son of Remaliah, Ahaz, the son of Jotham, king of Judah, began to reign. 20 years old was Ahaz when he began to reign, and he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem, and did not that which was right in the sight of the Lord his God, like David his father. But he walked in the ways of the king of Israel, yea, he made his sons to pass through the fire, according to the abomination of the heathen, whom the Lord cast out before the children of Israel. And he sacrificed and burnt incense in the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Here's a king of Israel. King of Israel. And he offers up a son? And his thinking? To somehow have a prosperous reign? Beloved, this is a king of Judah. We're not talking about those nasty kings to the north. We're talking about someone in Jesus' lineage. Ahaz is a descendant. He's a member of that royal bloodline. By God's grace, he didn't burnt or kill the son that would eventually sit on the throne when he died and would continue the royal bloodline down the Bethlehem stable in Bethlehem of Ephrata 2,000 years ago. Look how close the devil came here. Which one of the sons did Ahaz get rid of? It wasn't the son that was carrying the seed of the Messiah, apparently. But that was awfully close, I think. Maybe too close at this time. Turn to the next chapter, chapter 17. Verse 16. And they left all the commandments of the Lord their God and made them molten images, even two calves, and made a grove and worshipped all the host of heaven and served Baal. And they caused their sons and their daughters to pass through the fire and used divination and enchantments and sold themselves to do evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. Therefore, the Lord was very angry with Israel and removed them out of his sight. There was not left but the tribe of Judah only. Also, Judah kept not the commandments of the Lord their God, but walked in the statutes of Israel, which they made. Look at verse 17. Look at verse 17. That's not describing the Moabites, the Egyptians, the Hyssops, the Babylonians, the Persians, the Romans, the Greeks. You're talking about God's covenanted people. And notice, it's in the plural. And notice, both genders were sacrificed. Who or what was behind all this? The red dragon of Revelation 12. His design is to lie, cheat, steal, and yes, kill. One more. 2 Chronicles 33. 2 Chronicles 33. Now, we're not going to touch on it because when you come to the New Testament, you have Herod the Great. Upon the arrival of the wise men, or the magi, who were more in number than just three. When Herod is told, where is he who was born king of the Jews, that we may go and worship him? Herod in his little pea brain was thinking, I'm king of Israel. I'm king of Judah. By the dictates of the Roman Senate. Who's this contender? What was Herod's response when the wise men left another way? Not worship, murder. So even there, the red dragon was behind Herod the Great, whispering in his demonic mind to eliminate the young child living in the house whom the Magi had just visited. Even there. That's the New Testament. We're looking at the bloodshed of the old. Look at verse 6. And he caused his children to pass through the fire in the valley of the son of Hinnom. Also he observed times and used enchantments and used witchcraft, dealt with the familiar spirit and with wizards. He wrought much evil in the sight of the Lord to provoke him to anger. And he set a carved image, the idol which he had made in the house of God, of which God had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen before all the tribes of Israel, will I put my name forever. Neither will I any more remove the foot of Israel from out of the land which I have appointed for your fathers, so that ye will take heed to do all that I have commanded them, according to the whole law and the statutes and the ordinances of the hand of Moses. So Manasseh made Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to err and to do worse than the heathen. You may want to underline those few words. Here's King Manasseh, who was in the royal bloodline of the Lord Jesus Christ. He does things far worse than the heathen, whom the Lord had destroyed before the children of Israel. And the Lord spoke to Manasseh and to the people, but they would not hearken, like most church members today. Come to church, but with no desire to hear and no desire to do anything but put time and write a check. Look at that verse 6. Look what Manasseh did. He caused his children, that's plural. Now stop and think. Manasseh's in the royal bloodline. If he's out there killing his children, which son or daughter was left to keep that thin red that very thin thread of that royal line to continue? Who was behind Manasseh? And you can tell right off the bat, he observed times, he used enchantments, witchcraft, he even talked with demons or familiar spirits, and with wizards. Our beloved, this man threw his hat in the ring. He sold himself to evil. And since he's killing his own children, which child survived providentially to maintain that royal bloodline? Once again, look how close we came. Look how close we came to having that royal bloodline permanently extinguished centuries before the birth of Christ would have ever occurred. And then finally we have the opening lines of Matthew's Gospel telling of King Herod the Great and his attempt to kill the young child living in a house. My dear friends, we have to be very careful in how we think and what type of a worldview that we're fashioning for ourselves. We're living in a time right now that killing a child is legal. And in some instances, even at the point of birth, even while the child only has its head and neck in the birth canal, you can still legally kill that child if the mother doesn't want it. And then we can have the child born, placed naked, without any blanket, no warmth, no food, no drink, no formula, left to cry, and then to die. And then we as a people have the nerve to say, God bless America. How can he bless us when we as a collective people in our worship hold up hands in praise, with blood, nationally speaking, dripping from our fingers and hands? God is under no obligation to bless that. Matter of fact, he may be in the process right now of cursing this country with the leadership and those in high office right now on their inflicting of pain and misery and despair and darkness on us, the nation, who allows the shedding of innocent blood. So a verse is saying, God bless us, everyone. we ought to be saying, as I close, God, have mercy on us all. Amen.